This is Patty Daniels. I'm the executive producer of Vermont Edition. We edit our podcast to be shorter and sweeter than what you might have heard on air. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It might seem like an oxymoron to talk about breaking archaeological news, but new discoveries happen all the time, and they help deepen our understanding of our own past. Right now, a team of archaeologists is conducting a dig at one of the most remote farms in Vermont, the Gaelic Farm in West Haven. The South Champlain Historical Ecology Project is digging there for the second summer now, and its early findings include some objects that may date back almost 11,000 years. Matt and Ellie Moriarty run the project.
The earliest evidence we found here is from a period referred to as late Paleo-Indian, probably at least 11,000 years ago. And this area would have looked dramatically different, very different trees. The Champlain Sea would not be all that far to the north.
It's fascinating that we can fill in so much to the prehistory of Vermont, you know, that 11,000 years ago there's people coming through this area. And so many people don't realize that we have that kind of prehistoric time depth and human activity in this part of New England.
That was Matt and Ellie Moriarty, who operate the South Champlain Historical Ecology Project and are conducting a dig on a farm in West Haven. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about what's new in archaeology and paint the picture of our history on this landscape. I'm joined by Jess Robinson, Vermont State Archaeologist. Jess, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So, is there such a thing as breaking news in Vermont archaeology?
Why, of course. there are new discoveries being brought forth every day, every week, every month.
Every day, really?
Well, you know, in my own mind, yes. I mean, there are a small but dedicated group of archaeologists who are out pretty much from thaw to freeze doing regulatory archaeology, or like the Moriartys, doing more academic public outreach-based archaeology through Castleton University. And so every day does bring a new discovery. And not all of them are earth-shattering, but certainly add to the large body of knowledge that in aggregate allows us to make meaningful discoveries about human past, both ancient and historic.
You mentioned a couple different kinds of archaeology, regulatory archaeology, and then this sort of academic or public outreach archaeology. What's the difference?
Yeah, regulatory archaeology is archaeology that's done under the auspices of a small set of either federal or state laws. Act 250 is probably one that people know quite well in the state. It is a very small percentage of the overall funds. I think it's 0.001%, but nevertheless, it does generate some amount of archaeological excavations every year. More broadly, Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act requires that federal undertakings or those that use federal money do an archaeological review. That less often than not results in shovels in the ground, but nevertheless, in aggregate over the course of the year, there's some archaeology done for that. Section 248, projects need a certificate of public good, require an archaeological review. Again, a small percentage of those get shovels in the ground. And then our state land law, 22 VSA. So in aggregate, those four keep a small group of consultants and individuals working over the course of the year to fulfill those regulatory requirements. And then academic archaeology is quite rare in Vermont until recently, and that's why I'm so happy that the Moriartys are doing this great public outreach, academic, well-articulated research design down in West Haven. And I actually just went down there for the first time to visit them the other week, and what a place. I mean, really, really blew my mind.
And really? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well,
us there.
The Buckner Preserve is located right at the confluence of the Pulteney and the southernmost extension of Lake Champlain. And it's an area that because it's a preserve, is rightfully protected from a lot of development. And we're cautious about excavating in places that are preserved because there's so many sites that are under threat that we could leverage some shovels in the ground to protect. But they had a really good research plan. The research the Nature Conservancy was on board, and I was happy to see it go forth. And you know, it's this ecosystem that's so unique, you know, snakes crawling through the trees. And the day after I was there, they had a 6-foot timber rattler go through their site. And wildlife like you can't believe, and the only lizard population in Vermont, and meadowlarks. And it brings you back in a very real, visceral way into what it was like 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. And bringing that to light through archaeology is really important, and liaising with the native community.
Well, what's so interesting is, you know, here you are talking about the nature there and how well preserved it is and how free of human activity in some ways now. And yet, presumably, what they're digging for is to look at what the human activity was in the past when, sure, there was all of this nature as well, but there were things happening and people on that landscape.
Absolutely. It was probably a very busy thoroughfare for travel, for trade, for exchange, for resource procurement and extraction, very productive fisheries, a major trade route up the Hudson, along the Pulteney and up into Lake Champlain. So yeah, I mean, there very well could on an average year be more people in that landform 1,000 years ago than there are today.
That's so cool. So just how do you find sites?
Yeah, it's a stepped process. So in the regulatory context, we review pretty much every permit application that goes through the state or the federal government. We have partners with VTrans. They employ two archaeologists that under a programmatic agreement do some of that work for transportation projects. And then the Green Mountain National Forest has an archaeologist on staff that monitors their own archaeological sites and resources on their lands. But otherwise, we look at every permit, and then the vast majority, we say no archaeological implications, continue on. A small set, we will then say, you know what, this needs a field visit or a more thorough review. A smaller number of those, then we say, you know what, these need shovels in the ground to determine whether a site is there or not. And when we do that, it is a sample. So we, you know, array a grid across the area that we determine is archaeologically sensitive within the project area or proposed project area. We dig small holes in the ground, determine if there's the presence or absence of an archaeological site. If there is, then it potentially will go to the next phase, which is more detailed, to determine whether it's significant. And that is a formal term that denotes whether it's potentially eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Then if at the end of the phase two it is, then we work with whoever the developer or public or private entity is to say, can you avoid it? Can you minimize the impacts? And if it can't be avoided, then extremely rarely it will go to what we call a phase three, which is the very detailed sort of National Geographic style dental picks and toothbrushes, careful excavation to try to, you know, extract as much information as possible out before it gets destroyed.
The picture that's painting for me, though, is one of finding things based on being prompted by a development rather than having a sense of our landscape and what the settlements in the past have looked like based on, you know, what we think was the most important places in Vermont. So does the royal we have a good picture, a good map of previous settlements? Or is it sort of, oh, well, here's the highway. We've got a, you know, new road coming in. Let's dig here. Oh, there's something or not. Like, is it just sort of haphazard?
Yeah. So it's a great question. And it's one, as the state archaeologist, I've been wrestling with a lot. Yeah. It's primarily predicated upon development. And so we didn't have a good idea in again, using the royal we in 1970 or 1980 about where, in aggregate, how people moved across the landscape. But in the Champlain Basin over the past 50 years or so, and with new mapping technologies, which I discussed on a previous program, we can begin to synthesize this data in really meaningful and interesting ways. And we're just beginning to do that. So yes, in aggregate, over those little projects have built up over time to give us this remarkable picture. outside of the Champlain Basin, though, in the eastern half of Vermont between the Green Mountains and the Connecticut, we have much less information because there's much less development. And we have actually talked at the Division for Historic Preservation, where I work, about sponsoring some more academic survey, you know, doing transects, digging in areas to try to fill this out in the eastern part of the state, doing it in a respectful and preservation-minded way, but to get a better idea of where sites might be so we can make more efficient the process, both academic and regulatory-wise in the future.
So that would be more like what people imagine when they think of a big dig that archaeologists who are professors and they're getting all of their grad students together and they're going and finding this important site. That's more of what you'd like to see us doing.
Yeah, exactly. Or even seeing the density of sites. They don't have to be the most important site, but just seeing the range of landforms or environmental locales where people might have been. I mean, in I have colleagues out west who, you know, they're benefited with a soil that doesn't aggregate very much. And so they will just send people with a GPS bearing and say, walk till sunset and tell me all the sites you find. And they get a very good picture of archaeological site locations across the landscape because we've been forested and deforested and reforested and we're a very dynamic landscape. It more often than not requires shovel test pits in the ground. So it's a little bit more time consuming, longer range planning. But nevertheless, I think is still something important to do.
So what do you know about our prehistory and the first native people on the landscape and then as European contact came and Europeans started coming through the landscape? Can you – I know it's like, you know, this is your life's work. And so I'm asking you to do it in just that sort of sped up reel of it. But what do we know?
Sure. Yeah. So starting at the beginning and the area that I concentrate on more in my own scholarship with my colleagues John Kroc at the University of Vermont and Weatherby Dorshow from the University of New Mexico is this first period where the glaciers receded from Vermont fully by about 13,400 years ago and then a series of glacial lakes because of that melting meltwater filled the basin and then they emptied out. And because the land was so depressed by the weight of all that glacial ice, it was lower in the Champlain Basin than the Atlantic. Seawater rushed in right around 13,000 years ago and thus began the tenure of the Champlain Sea, which was in the Champlain Basin for about 3,000 years or maybe even more until after 10,000 years ago. And that timeline, that beginning and end date, is only very recently, within the past 10 or 15 years ago, been nailed down by geologists. Before, it was thought that the Champlain Sea came and went long before humans were in this area. But about 10 years ago, we started to piece together that, in fact, the Champlain Sea was here when these first Native Americans that we perhaps unfortunately call Paleo-Indians – it's just one of those terms that sticks around no matter how much we try to get rid of it – that they were here when the Champlain Sea was here. And so what my colleagues and I have done is map these sites in relation to a very refined model of the Champlain Sea, the most recent iteration of which was done by George Springsteen at Norwich University, which is remarkable and leverages LIDAR that VCGI has done. And what we see is that these Paleo-Indian groups were occupying perhaps island-like landforms in the lake and that they the majority of the sites were congregating right on the margins of the Champlain Sea, suggesting that Paleo-Indians, which have traditionally been known as these big game hunters, terrestrial sort of caribou or mastodon hunters, that they were very interested in and very likely hunting and pursuing marine mammals or shellfish or fish, which we know were abundant in the Champlain Sea. And what's remarkable about that isn't just overturning these old stereotypes of these people, but that Vermont is the only landlocked state in New England, and yet we're the only area that now preserves above water the shorelines of the Champlain Sea because everywhere else is now inundated by rising Atlantic water. So ironically, the only evidence, if it exists, of maritime use or maritime environments is in Vermont and in the eastern side of New York in the Champlain Basin. And so it's a really astounding thing. Now, you know, we haven't found the spear point in the whale skull yet. And so it's, you know, somewhat indirect evidence. And I think it's in aggregate, it's a pretty convincing case.
That's really going to be breaking news.
It's yeah, no kidding. When that happens, you'll hear about it probably from me. And then going on in time, you know, thousands of years of native occupation, which get increasingly more populous, adapting to their landscape in really remarkable ways. But what we do see in aggregate is that there's a real coastal interior divide in the archaic period, these thousands of years prior to 3,000 years ago. Coastal hunters were very concentrated on marine mammals, swordfish, deep water fish. And then interior folks are more forest oriented. And then around 3,000 years ago, that really begins to change. And there's no longer this strict coastal interior adaptations. And we start to see these exchange networks rise up. And we're not sure why. And exchange networks were long thought to be a product of social differentiation and hierarchy and the rise of, you know, fostered through surplus and wealth. And yet we don't see that here. What we potentially see and what I've written a little bit about is that it might have been actually a time of crisis or a time of need. And perhaps that was spurring this trade, connections with people farther out to try to leverage some contacts, risk buffer, and also to give prestige to certain people within the communities, perhaps religious people that didn't otherwise have it.
This is what I love about archaeology, though, is because, you know, I studied anthropology and more modern social structures, and you do so much of that through observation. And what I love about archaeology is you're using observation and found artifacts, but then you have to do all this analysis and make these ideas and say, this is what I think happened. And then you go back to the record and try to figure out if what you think is actually correct and do more observation and look at more artifacts and see how they've been used. And I think it's fascinating. Today, we're spending some time going back into our past. Today's humans are learning about yesterday's humans through archaeological digs, by examining artifacts, by looking at what a different landscape meant for human development, and how human development has changed our landscape. And we're talking about all of it with state archaeologist Jess Robinson. And before we get into interactions with Native Americans and Europeans who came in through the North, let's go to Chip, who's calling in from Rockingham. Hi, Chip. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Before I present my question, I'd just like to say, that discussion about the reason for interchange of goods is a really great one, and I don't think that our motivations have changed since, you know, 10,000 or 13 or 25,000 years ago, which is accumulation of enough to not only subsist, but to establish a bank account of status, which exerts influence on the social scene. Anyway, my question was, how do I find someone who may be interested in taking a look at our place, which sits at the very top of a ridgeline that runs from the West River and Connecticut River confluence, and incredible flyway for birds, and I would imagine that also people followed this ridgeline. We have a view of the Putney Pinnacle, it's like a fish hook, like I said, and the North Star sits right above the hill at the top of the hollow, and I've found a number of stones that are set up and aligned in such a way that they look directly down through the Athens Gap and along that ridgeline, which basically goes south. And over the last almost three decades, I've found quite a bit of interesting stuff there, and I just would like to know how I get somebody to come up and take a look.
Chip, it doesn't sound like it would be hard. It sounds like just taking a walk with you on your property would be a pretty wonderful afternoon. But Jess Robinson, how does somebody like Chip find someone to come out and take a look?
Yeah, so that's probably me or one of my colleagues, Yvonne or Scott, in my office. I have a sort of backlog of these, and it is not because I'm not interested, but I just – have a lot to do. But so what I try to do is organize a day where, okay, I'm in the southeastern portion of the state and I'll try to go visit as many as I can. So Chip, I would just say, shoot me an email and absolutely, I'm very interested. More generally, I would say the confluence of the West and the Connecticut has been known prehistorically and historically as a site of major importance. Obviously, the petroglyphs that Annette Spaulding just found that were inundated after the building of the 1918 dam are really important. We know of a lot of Native American archaeological sites in that area. Historically, we know that the West River, Connecticut River confluence was important to get into the interior, both by early soldiers and Native Americans passing from the Champlain Basin and back. An area with a remarkable amount of history. And so I have no doubt that the place you describe is very important. And I'd love to come visit it at some point.
Speaking of what Chip's talking about, AP says, when I grew up in the Albany, New York area, we would bring found items once a year to the State Museum for the state archaeologist and other experts to examine. Does the Vermont archaeologist offer anything similar?
Yes. I don't offer a day, although Vermont Archaeology Month is coming up and I would be remiss if I didn't promote it. It's all through September and we have a range of events and I encourage you to check out the Vermont Archaeology Month Facebook page. Which actually goes on all year long because Vermont archaeology was already taken. I do believe we're having an event at the Echo Lake Aquarium and Science Center where a colleague of mine will identify artifacts. But more generally, I run the Vermont Archaeology Heritage Center as one of the hats I wear. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm there and you can always stop by or – if you have a cell phone with a camera, take a picture of it, and I'm happy to answer those emails. And I do that all the time, and I'm pleased to do that for folks.
What happens if somebody on their own private property finds something? Does the state automatically get it if it's an important find?
No, and this is a point that I'd like to make clear. If you find something on your own private property, it is yours. And indeed, excavations are being done where you are not relinquishing the right to that property for a development or a power line. They are still your property. Now, we do encourage donation in those cases where there's, you know, a detailed archaeological site done to be donated to the Heritage Center, and we're certainly grateful for that, and we preserve those artifacts in perpetuity. But if you do not wish to, they are yours. And so, I would love to dispel any sort of myth that we're going to come and take your property, you know, your artifacts or anything like that. No, I mean, I often tell students that I teach that at this point, I am way more happy to have the information than even to have an artifact in hand. Artifacts are great for the information you can wring out of them now and in the future, but data is important. And so I'm happy to just – you don't have to tell me where it's from and I'll answer what I can. But context matters. And so if we know where it's found, I can probably give you a little more information. And if you wanted to tell us where it was found, we can put it in our site records. And that's all great. But it's as much or as little as you want to do.
Dennis in Burlington says, there's a great deal of road and other construction going on in Chittenden County right now. Any finds? What should professional or even amateur diggers be on the lookout for?
There is road work going on right now. A lot of that was done, the archaeology for that was actually done almost a decade ago. If you're thinking about Route 7, for instance.
Route 7 goes from Burlington and above all the way down through the Middlebury area and down. It's a major thoroughfare through the state.
Exactly. And if you've traveled from Burlington south and you've hit all that construction, the widening of Route 7 in those areas, actually the archaeology for that was done in around 2000, the late 1990s. And so the Agency of Transportation in particular usually does surveys far out of any potential building. But there was some remarkable stuff that was found along that, not just Native American things, but also a very early homestead in Charlotte that I know well because it was one of the first excavations I worked on as a professional archaeologist, and also because everyone got wild parsnip before we knew what it was, and it scared everybody. But yes, there was some remarkable stuff coming out through those excavations.
You mentioned to me before the show that also the natural gas pipeline being built, well, has been built through Addison County, there was some excavation done during that as well.
Yeah, so Vermont Gas really did a great job avoiding or mitigating any archaeological resources that were in the path of the pipeline. And I all of the sites and the artifacts from that pipeline route are still being analyzed, but I think the number was 56 archaeological sites were uncovered. And, in one valley, I think we radiocarbon dated fire hearths, and again, using the royal we, that, spanned this interesting period from about 5,000 years ago to about 2,000 years ago.
That you were talking about earlier when you see these trade networks cropping up?
We see some evidence of trade there, but more just these sort of tertiary little valleys, which, you wouldn't think would be these major population centers. And again, there's a time lap, but repeatedly, just every time, a series of fire hearths, storage pits, dating to this archaic period, which was very interesting. And then on the flip side, in the area that used to be known as Barnum Town, a very early homestead from the 1790s, the gentlemen seem to have been very clumsy because UVM found so much coinage, and so
it's
he
like
probably
the equivalent of like in the couch cushions.
Yeah, except probably through the floorboards. But I believe, and I might be mistaken, but I believe he was an early doctor in Barnum Town, and so a really interesting slice of life through the artifacts about these earliest residents and that area. And, many other things were found that, my recall exactly, it's been a few years, but the final report for that hasn't been completed yet, but when it is, it'll be remarkable.
So you're bringing us into European settlement and descendants of early European settlers who arrived in Vermont. And I had stopped you in our history lesson. So can you bring us up to speed?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so, archaeologically, humanly, the contact between Native Americans and Europeans was obviously not smooth. It was devastating to Native American groups everywhere. Less is known about that contact in Vermont because Vermont really was the frontier. There was in the Champlain Valley an early French presence. And then in the southeastern part of the state, in the Vernon, Brattleboro area, there was an English presence. And then everywhere in between, I always show this map when I give lectures of this 1760 map that still said uncharted wilderness belonging to the English crown. And so it was homesteaded and everything fairly late. But the record is very unclear. And so both for Native Americans and then Europeans, those first generations of farmers, those frontier farmers, not a lot was written about. The history was written about the great events of the day, the wars, the quote-unquote big men or big people. But the average farmer and how they made their way in this very rugged landscape, a lot can be done to fill out that picture through archaeology, and has been over time by some remarkable researchers, getting a picture of just how rugged it was and what they utilized on an everyday basis, how they cleared fields, the tools that they used and then had to repurpose. Really remarkable, and archaeology is a very important story to tell.
Christopher says, I'd like to know if the petroglyphs in Bellows Falls are authentic. Were those rock carvings done by pre-European inhabitants? And if they were, how were they dated?
So they first of all, they are authentic. We have illustrations and etchings going all the way back to the 1860s. Why they might look not authentic, however, is that the Daughters of the American Revolution, I believe in the 1920s, fearing that they were eroding away, repecked them out and then at a later point painted them yellow. And so I can understand why you might think that they're no longer authentic. But they are. They, to the best of our knowledge, they pecked out exactly what they saw. It might not be perfect, but it matches those early etchings. And dating wise, it's tricky. There's no way to directly date a petroglyph. Radiocarbon dating relies on organic materials, and obviously there's none of those in the rock. But by the motifs and the different imagery, there's some theories by colleagues and me that they're probably date to what we call the early woodland period, or this period between about 3,000 and 2,000 years ago. That's a very rough estimate, but yes, that is our best thought right now.
Let's go to another caller calling in from Dummerston. Hi there, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a great question. I've been wondering about this rock that I found in the river, in Shackens River, for a long time. And it's a very large rock, but it looks like it's been carved into almost like a skull-shaped, very planed face, the eyes and the face. So it looks like a small skull. And I've been wondering if it's some kind of marker from a grave, Abenaki or some native people, even colonists. I don't really know what to do with it. It's very interesting.
Oh, what an interesting find. And that's Diana calling in from Dummerston.
Hey, Diana. Yeah. So with the caveat that rivers do some very interesting things to rocks and form them into all different things. It very well could be something. I haven't heard of certainly an Abenaki grave being marked with any sort of skull imagery. That's not typically what they would design things with. Certainly historically, skull motifs are quite common. And so if you have a camera or a cell phone with a camera, feel free to shoot me an email and I'd be happy to let you know if it's natural or cultural or give you my best idea about what it might be.
Jess, how far back, or I guess the correct way to say it is, how close to the present do you count as archaeology? I mean, we're not looking at trash mittens from the 1980s.
No, although I will say that there are archaeologists that actually do excavate in trash mittens to determine things like patterns of discard and what people are throwing away through time, consumption,
even through sort
and
of modern humans.
Yeah, modern humans. There's a famous story about doing an excavation to try to find these lost ET cartridges.
That's right. Yeah, in the dump.
Yeah. Exactly. But no, in Vermont, technically anything 50 years or older is considered historic or potentially historic, and if it falls under a number of criteria, integrity, significance, all of these things. But we tend to privilege things that are unique, can contribute to our knowledge. The further you go back, the more weight we give on historic archaeological sites, with a number of caveats. Military sites are obviously important. Early industrial sites, so the Elizabeth, the Ely, the Pike Hill mines are very important for early industry, and they go up into the 1920s. But generally, while we certainly evaluate the potential threats to any historic site, it's pre-Civil War usually gets more weight before this weight of historic records really begins to grow.
Jess, you've been in this job now as state archaeologist for what, about 2 years?
3 years.
Oh,
yeah.
Three.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm
getting close.
Yeah, and still liking it?
Love it. Yeah, love it. It is extremely rewarding. I learn something new every day. I do put less shovels in the ground or trowels in the ground than I used to, but it is great. And being a Vermonter having the rare opportunity to practice what I love in my home state, I couldn't be more grateful.
Well, we're grateful to you for being here today. Fascinating conversation. I appreciate it. And when you get the report out from the gas pipeline, all of the archaeological findings, will you come back and tell us about it?
Absolutely.
Great. Jess Robinson is Vermont State Archaeologist.